This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with attorney Robert R. Bryan from San Francisco about the oral arguments in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal before the Third Circuit last week in Philadelphia. We'll also hear an excerpt from a speech at the Left Forum by Sophia Elijah on prisons, prisoners, and political prisoners, chaired by our own Michael Smith. We'll hear more speeches from a recent protest in New York against the release of admitted former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Recently, we brought you the voices of activists and attorneys outside the Third Circuit Court in Philadelphia, all responding to the oral arguments in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Today, we have a chance to speak with lead attorney Robert R. Bryan from San Francisco. The former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, Mr. Bryan's career spans more than three decades and has included other highly political cases, such as representing leaders of the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee. We're delighted to have Robert Bryan on the program. Robert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here, Heidi.
Robert, last week for many of us was a historic week. Can you tell us what was at stake in the oral arguments for Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Literally, the life of my client is on the line, Heidi. It was a life or death situation, and now we're anxiously waiting a decision by the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which I think is going to, there's no way of really knowing, but my guesstimate is that we'll probably get a decision in maybe 45 to 90 days, even though the court was well prepared, the three judges, so it could be faster. But what we were arguing in court, and it's interesting that we spent the morning in this packed courtroom before this august three-judge panel, not talking about specifically my client so much, but talking about the crime of racism, I call it a crime, the constitutional wrongs committed by the District Attorney's Office of Philadelphia. That was the whole focus. I'd say 10% was spent on the death penalty, which the court felt was inappropriately applied in this case, and that if it's reversed on that issue, there'd be another trial on that issue. But the court seemed more concerned, as you know, because you're one of the lawyers in the case and you were there, The court seemed far more concerned with the racism in jury selection by the district attorney's office. The district attorney was on trial, if you will.
Tell us, for listeners who may not be aware of the history of 26 or so years ago, when Mr. Abu-Jamal was accused of this, what was happening in Philadelphia?
The police department and really the district attorney's office was riddled with corruption, and it was the order of the day for prosecutors in murder cases, particularly in capital murder cases, to systematically remove people for no other reason except for the color of their skin, which happened to be African-American. I summed it up when I went back up for a rebuttal. I had the final word. I'd filed a motion. Otherwise, I would not have received it, but the court...
That's kind of unusual, isn't it, in this kind of...
It was unusual for the amicus curiae friend of the court counsel to even be able to argue, which was, of course, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which I'd asked to come in a couple of years ago. Of course, the National Lawyers Guild, which also was very kind in acceding to my request to come into the case. But when I got back up, I had my main argument, and there were the other arguments and by other counsel. And then when I got back up to do my rebuttal, this unusual rebuttal because there were cross appeals, just in a couple of minutes summed it up. You know, look at it, if you will, as bookends. Every case is documented by judicial decisions. Before trial of Mumia Abdul-Jamal in 1982, the prosecution systematically removed African-Americans. Every trial after, they removed people who were black. And are we to believe, and I said, this is a rhetorical question, and I looked at the three judges, you know, eye contact with each one. I said, are we to believe that the prosecution, the district attorney's office, decided in this one case involving a former Black Panther supportive of MOVE's right to be different, an outspoken journalist against racism and corruption in the police department and the district attorney's office, are we to believe that in this one case the prosecution decided not to employ racism in its selection of a jury? That's the way the other case ended, and apparently a lot of the journalists, both locally and internationally, who were there felt that pretty well just was right on target and summed up just the sordid mess involving corruption by the district attorney's office. And what really bothers me about this, Heidi, is that, as you well know, because you and the Guild do so much work around the country against this type of thing, is that on the issue of slavery, states and countries in recent times have admitted their wrongs. And yet, here we are over 24 years after the trial, and the district attorney's office, the government, is still trying to keep a lid on their wrongs, on their constitutional sins, crimes, rather than just admitting, okay, we made mistakes back at that time, but it's a different day, but we admit it.
They're holding strong to the party line.
It's like the wrongs of the past are visited on the present. It continues, the racism, which has been a thread in this case from the beginning.
Robert, I must say that your closing was indeed one of the highlights, if not the highlight, of the oral arguments for many of us, because you did so succinctly bring us back, and I believe you mentioned there's case law to support the fact that race discrimination infected the cases right after and before Mr. Abdul-Jamal's. And really, I don't think there's any reply to that, because you're right, and it's on the record. How did it feel after all this time to finally be before those three judges who were indeed so well prepared and, in my opinion, seemed very favorable to the defense arguments?
I'll pick up the language of Mumia. We talked that evening when I got back to New York. I'm in San Francisco, but I was in New York at the time. And Mumia, we had arranged for a legal conference that evening, and I told him what had happened and asked him how he felt. And he said, I feel very humble, because this is really not about me, it's about all people in death row around the world, which he's become a symbol. For me, as his lawyer, I realize that this is the first time since his arrest over a quarter of a century ago that there is light at the end of the tunnel. This is the big opportunity to turn this case around and get a new trial. And my goal, our goal, because you've been involved in a lot of this, is to not only get a new trial, but I want to do in this case what I've done in many, many other capital cases, and that is I want a jury acquittal. I want him to walk out of that courtroom a free person and go back home to his family. You mentioned the court judges were very well prepared, and I had just argued a similar case involving same issue, racism and jury selection, before the California Supreme Court 2 weeks before, and the court here was very well prepared. But I was stunned at the preparedness of these judges. I mean, from the beginning to the end. But I thought the high point was just all these questions they were asking. It was interesting. They had such a keen interest in this case. But to realize that if we lose everything, and as you know, the Supreme Court rarely grants relief in these cases. So if we lose at this stage, and Mamie and I have talked about this, you know, I'm going to be seeing my client executed. If we win, then the opposite will happen.
Well, that's, of course. Judge Yon had reversed the death sentence a few years ago, yet Mumia is still on death row. Is it a possibility that they will reinstate the death sentence? And do you think if they do, it will be, because of the politicized nature of this case, they might just keep Mumia on death row for several years?
No, they can't do that. They can't do that. Ah. The court has two options regarding the death penalty. Either affirm the lower court and Mumia remained on death row, even though the court found that the death penalty was unconstitutionally imposed because the prosecution appealed. So Mamiya to this day remains in this small cell, smaller than most of our bathrooms, on death row in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. If we win, if the U.S. Court of Appeals upholds the lower federal court, what it means is a new trial on the question of life or death before a jury, and the jury would decide whether Mamiya is to be die at the hands of the executioner or by old age in prison. Either way, he stays in prison. There's no way any decision could just result in him just vegetating, appellate decision, him vegetating on death row. Either he gets a new death penalty trial or he gets executed. But we've got these three other giant constitutional issues: racism and jury selection, of the bias and racism of the judge, who incidentally said during the trial, during the recess, his words, not Robert Bryant's, "I'm going to help him fry the nigger," referring to Mamiya, and he wanted to see him executed, and also that the prosecutor turned the concept of reasonable doubt, that constitutional right, on its head in his argument.
And let's just briefly talk about that, meaning that the jurors were led to believe that they were inclined, after the prosecutor spoke, to want to vote for death.
Well, what he said, Heidi, what the prosecutor told the jury was, and this is at the guilt phase, not the penalty phase, the second stage,
right,
is if you make a mistake, and I'll use his words, there will be appeal after appeal. But if you let him go, there's nothing I or the judge can do about it. In other words, if the jury was going to err, make a mistake, make it on the side of leaning towards guilt rather than innocence, which is the opposite of what constitutionally our legal system is based on. I only mentioned that at one point in my argument. I didn't even go into it because the prosecutor, because he initially appealed, had the first argument. And the judges took him to task on that. They said, how can you say this is not a violation of the Constitution, turning reasonable doubt? And they used my words, the language that I had put in the brief, turning reasonable doubt and presumption of innocence on his head. And when I heard them using my actual language, quoting me, I decided that, you know, we don't need to take up time very much on this. I mean, I hope they'll rule favorably, but time will tell.
Yeah, it seemed that was one of the first issues they raised, in fact. Let's just talk briefly. There was also an issue which we call the Mills issue, relating to the actual form that the jurors had to fill out on aggravating and mitigating circumstances, the jury form. How do you think that will go?
I felt at the outset, and I might say that the prosecutor started with that, and the judges just jumped on him within the first 30 or 45 seconds, asking him, how can you justify this constitutionally? Because what the judge had instructed the jury was that, you know, there are mitigating circumstances, and like one, it could be a person's age, it could be a person's good works, the fact that a person doesn't have any criminal record, you know, all of these type of things. And what the judge says, that the jury, all 12 jurors, have to agree on any single one for it to apply, otherwise it doesn't. So if you felt that Mamiya's good works was a reason for not imposing a death penalty, and I felt it was because he's a great journalist, then we would have to disregard those because we weren't on the same points. Judith Ritter, who's a guild member, who's a law professor, who's my associate counsel, did a brilliant job. She, you know, responding to what the prosecutor was arguing, and I kind of sat there with envy because I thought I should have taken this issue because the judges all seem to agree. So that's a very powerful issue. We want a total reversal. We want a new trial.
Now, if the judges rule, say, just on that jury form issue, even though in the face of all the evidence on racism, say they just rule on that, is just that issue sent back to be reviewed?
Well, they would rule on all the issues, but let's say they denied relief to us on every issue but that one. And if they granted relief on that, we would go back, yes. The answer would be yes, strictly on the issue of before a jury in Philadelphia, of whether Mamiya would receive a life sentence or a death sentence. But it would be like a retrial of the entire case because the prosecution would be able to, they're entitled, unfortunately, to go into what gave the basis for the original verdict, we would put on evidence countering that, which there's a wealth of, and also a lot of evidence about this incredible journalist who continues his journalism from death row.
Right. Now, he's written, what is it, 5 books?
Yes, and his last one was on the history of the Black Panther Party. And I just say, as close as Mamiya and I are, and he started writing me in 1986, over 21 years ago, asking that I can represent him, I'm amazed that he can turn out books and weekly journalism commentaries from, as I said, this cell that's smaller than most of our bathrooms, dark cell on death row. It's incredible.
Just because I don't think many of our listeners have the privilege of learning what it is like for him, he's limited in his cell to the amount of possessions he can have. Is that correct? Or is space just a consideration? So he writes so much, and I know he receives so much mail, he has to really pare things down.
It goes periodically to his family, his wife in Philadelphia.
I see. Right. And how is he treated on death row?
It's interesting. When I go in, the guards seem to have great respect for him because they know that, you know, I'm sure they begrudgingly do not like to admit it, but here's somebody who has a far more superior intellect to most people, certainly prison guards. But he's a very nice and quiet, humble person. And the other inmates, there was recently an article that went out on the wire service internationally. There was a reference to him being called Pops by other inmates, and he does a lot of death house lawyering.
Jailhouse lawyering, yes, helping others work on their appeals.
And he's had great success. I mean, people have actually had reversals because of his work from death row.
Amazing. And I know. Let me just interrupt. The Guild, actually, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, has a publication, the Jailhouse Lawyer Handbook, and we sent a draft to Mumia, who was very helpful while that was in progress, and we really owe a debt of gratitude to him for this service. We get hundreds of requests monthly for it. Robert, how's the PBA? I know there's a strong lobby to bring negative coverage to this case in the Philadelphia police community. I didn't see as many police officers in the courtroom as expected.
Well, what happened, and it's interesting, afterwards I had lunch with a delegation of people from France and also a lawyer from Berlin, Germany, who was there on behalf of the Berlin Bar, and he's also a member of the parliament there, who had come specifically to cover the case internationally as watchers, constitutional watchers. I noticed when we were sitting at lunch eating our little sandwiches near the federal building, I noticed police officers coming in and out of this little sandwich shop. And every one of them had a black ribbon across his or her police badge. And that was...
Right. A mourning band.
Exactly. They were in mourning. And so they did it that way. And they had a big meeting at the Fraternal Order of Police, the FOP, afterwards, I understand. But the widow of the of this cop who was killed was there. The former prosecutor, the racist prosecutor, was there. Leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police were there, so, but they tactically decided not to pack the courtroom with cops, which was
right. Well, I must say there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer that I thought was quite well balanced in terms of press coverage of this case. That really, I think, I don't know if you were quoted, but you saw that article, and that to me is a good sign that maybe with the passage of time and the number of death row inmates who are being exonerated, that maybe there is a slight shift.
That article did not just happen. The reporter had contacted me some weeks before on some other litigation we were in this case leading up to the oral argument. And rather than just flipping her off and saying, well, I'm not going to talk to you because you people have not been fair to me in the past, you know, I was open, and I told her how Mumia and I feel, and that is we do not ask any journalist, reporter, to favor one side or the other. We just ask to be fair. And I asked this lady, who's a very good reporter, I said, go just be fair. That's all. I know you have to report both sides, and that's fine. And she wound up quoting me. I think that's the article in which she that went out internationally, that she referred to Mumia as Pops. He helped other death row inmates avoid being executed. And so, yes, that was a major step in the right direction.
Well, how do you feel now, Robert? You're going to have a little break before you continue?
No break. I'm actually spent all day yesterday. I'm spending today dealing with some things with the court directly that the court's asked me to deal with, some of us counsel, in the aftermath of oral argument. And, you know, I've tried probably over 100 murder cases, actually, with juries through the years. Used to do a lot in the South back in the old days with great success, and my clients were almost always African-American. Even though this case is on federal appeal, I feel like the jury is deliberating, and that's the worst feeling in the world. Mm. I mean, I'm always the ultimate pessimist, but I don't feel that way now. I have some hope, and let's just hope that's borne out, this glimmer of optimism I have. But no, I feel very uncomfortable right now, because I know the life and future of a very good person is in the hands of three white judges, two of whom were appointed by Ronald Reagan.
This is true, Robert, but many of us who had the honor of being there in the courtroom with you really felt that the judges were intelligent, well aware, as you've said, really knew the case inside and out. And I know we're not supposed to speculate on how it will turn out, but they had at least one or two, and in my feeling, three very strong legal arguments for a new trial or at least new hearings, and they really seemed to favor the defense, Robert.
Well, that was the perception a lot of people have, and I hope that's an accurate perception. I will say, as we mentioned earlier, that they were very well prepared, and I was impressed with their questioning. And well, let's just hope that politics, even on a subconscious basis, does not have an effect. That they
right.
decide, if they decide the case strictly on the law,
we're in good shape.
Yes, we're in good. And I want to, again, just I know we've got to wind this up, but thank the National Lawyers Guild, particularly for your steadfast support of Mamiya through the years before you got involved directly in the legal proceedings as friend of the court. And, of course, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Professor Judith Ritter, Francis Golden, Mamiya's literary agent, and so many hundreds, thousands of people both here and in Europe who care about human rights. And that's basically what this is all about.
Robert Bryan, thank you so much. And we'll all be really hoping for the best in this case. Thank you for your hard work and for what was really a fabulous day in court.
Well, thank you, Heidi. And it's truly an honor for Mamiya and me for you to have us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Robert.
Bye.
The only thing we know is he was framed up, he's innocent, and the reason why is because he's a revolutionary.
Yes, sir.
If they kill him or keep him on death row, any of us could be next. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Free Mumia Abu-Jamal!
We recently broadcasted speeches from the demonstration in New York voicing opposition to the release of admitted former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles. He's accused of being one of the masterminds of a 1976 mid-air explosion that demolished a Cuban airliner, killing 73 innocent people. This demonstration was among other protests being conducted worldwide, including Canada, Mexico, Central and South America. We will hear speeches from Father Luis Barrios of the Iglesia San Romero de las Americas. Let's have a listen.
Okay, our next speaker is Father Barrios from San Romero de las Americas.
Good afternoon, people. How are we doing? We still have the spirit. We're fighting back. We're fighting back. We're fighting back. We're fighting back.
Yeah.
Yes, it's good to be here. We're passing out a very important message. I was thinking, so I don't have to repeat what the other people so eloquent already said. I was thinking, as a religious person, thinking about Bush religiosity, because he liked to talk a lot about being a religious person. But as a religious person, I can tell you that he's very evil. This man is very, very evil. I can't believe how he dared to call himself a Christian, to take a Bible, to go to church, or the way he say that he's praying to God. I'm not ready to what kind of God this man is praying. It's clear that Luis Posada Carriles is free just because George W. Bush allowed him to go free. This is not going to happen without the blessing of the President of the United States. We understand that. And we understand that a person like George Bush, who is not supposed to be in power, who is not my president, someone that we need to impeach together with the vice president, we have the responsibility to call things by the name. George Bush is a terrorist. 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 That's the only reason why he's protecting Luis Posada Carriles, Orlando Bosch, and all those crazy people that belongs to this crazy leadership in Miami from the Cuban community. Because not all the Cubans in Miami belongs to these groups. This is a very selective group being protected by the USA government. It's very interesting the way Bush defined his theology. Illegal, but legitimate. This is Bush theology. I know it's illegal, but it's legitimate. If it's illegal, it's wrong. It's wrong, and it's wrong. Why the hell are you saying that it's legitimate? It's not. And that's the reason why, as a religious person, when people start asking me, why is that you can build a relationship like someone like Fidel Castro who do not believe in God? Like, I really care if you believe in God or do not believe in God. That's not my business. Okay? But this is what I'm concerned. I'm concerned that a person who do not believe in God, like Fidel Castro, he has so much respect for people, for life, for future. And then you have someone here who dare to open his mouth and say, I believe in God. And every Sunday he go to church with a Bible. And then he dare to go into Afghanistan and kill innocent people. Go into Iraq and kill innocent people. Allow a terrorist like Luis Posada Carriles to go free after killing all these people. And all the atrocities that he's doing, threatening Iran, the Palestine people, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela. This man is a threat because he is evil. And we need to stop him. I was talking to some of my students there at John Jay College last week. And I was asking them, so how many people Hitler killed? Okay? Don't tell me that he killed at least one. Okay? I'm concerned about 75 million Germans that kept silent, doing nothing, when all these atrocities were going on in Germany. So I'm concerned of what's going on here in the United States. 300 million people keeping silent when someone in the White House with all this craziness and atrocities is killing so many people and letting terrorists go free in this country. So I'm concerned, when the hell are we going to wake up? When is that we're going to become citizens with responsibility? And we're going to say, enough is enough. Bush out of power. And we're taking the responsibility. Free the Cuban Five. God bless.
Thank you, Father Barrios.
Extradite Posada. Free the Cuban Five.
Extradite Posada. Free the Cuban Five. Extradite Posada. Free the Cuban Five! Extradite Posada! Free the Cuban Five! Extradite Posada!
visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech by Sophia Elijah at the Left Forum in New York. The panel is entitled Prisons, Prisoners, and Political Prisoners, and it's chaired by our own Michael Smith. Sophia Elijah serves as Deputy Director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard Law School. Let's have a listen.
Sophia Elijah has been active for many, many years in support of and in defense of political prisoners. And she's going to speak particularly about the newest outrage, and that's the attempt of this government to try to put the final nail in the coffin of the Black Panther Party.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And first I want to say thank you to Michael and to the organizers of the Left Forum for inviting me to speak today. It is an honor to join you. It's my first time speaking at the Left Forum, but I won't make it the last.
You won't be. Okay.
I am going to focus on the issue of political prisoners, but in order to put them in context, of course, it's very important for us to understand how it is that political activists become criminalized and therefore become incarcerated. And I want to focus for a moment not so much on what you might see as the traditional political prisoner or political activity that would land someone in prison. And I want to shift, and probably some of you are going to say, whoa, how did she get there? I'm going to shift for a moment to the travel restrictions to going to Cuba. How many of you are familiar with those restrictions? Good, good. Then those of you who are familiar with it would also understand that it's not, quote unquote, illegal to travel to Cuba. What's illegal is to what? Spend money. All right, now we all live in a capitalist society, so you know you don't get to do anything without spending money. You don't even get to get locked up nowadays without spending money. So you certainly are not allowed to spend money going to Cuba. And I'm sure many of you know that there are various groups who have launched travel challenges to those restrictions, and they have openly traveled to Cuba, the Venceslao Ramos Brigade, Pastors for Peace, and other similar organizations. Everybody knows that? And by and large, the penalties have been civil penalties, right? So guess what? You get to spend money if you are deemed to have violated the travel restrictions, and it's the Department of Treasury that in fact oversees the enforcement of the travel restrictions. But recently, your government has decided that they're going to push to criminalize travel to Cuba. Okay? So that's one small instance of where we take political activity, the civil disobedience of traveling to Cuba and spending money openly, challenging the fact that there shouldn't be any restrictions on going to Cuba, and suddenly making that a criminal act. And just recently, two men in Florida have been charged with facilitating travel to Cuba by using religious licenses as a fraud to enable people to travel to Cuba. And by and large, it's Cuban Americans who left Cuba who want to return to visit family members who have been using those licenses to get back to see their family members. So in a very short sweep of the hand, we may well see a whole different crop of political prisoners, the people who have been violating the law, quote unquote, right, because they dare to travel to do what? To see their family members and spend money. I use that example as a small example of how the government manipulates political action and position and criminalizes it to maintain control. With that format, that sets the backdrop for how we have an unbelievable number of political prisoners incarcerated in the United States today. And they come from various movements, the Black Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Native American Movement. We also have the Earth Liberation People now, the animal rights folks. And as a friend of mine once said, we'll even have people who are fighting against the bird flu. Because more and more we see the use of criminalization to squash political dissent. But in the, in the 1950s, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, instituted a program called COINTELPRO. Is there anyone in here who's not familiar with that term? Come on, raise it high. Okay, so I know who I'm talking to. Good. All right, there should always be somebody in the audience who I'm reaching out to, otherwise why am I here? Okay, so COINTELPRO is a counterintelligence program, and I'm saying is, I chose that tense on purpose, all right? COINTELPRO was initiated by Hoover in the 1950s to go after, quote unquote, the Communist Party and the radical left. You know those people, right? Okay. Hoover was not happy about the fact that he felt that the courts were being too liberal with the left, particularly with respect to their ability to travel. Right? Interesting how travel finds its way back into this scenario. But quickly, Hoover refocused his attention of COINTELPRO on what he called the New Left, okay, and the Black Liberation Movement and the Civil Rights Movement. One of his major targets of COINTELPRO was Martin Luther King. All right, he's a real dangerous terrorist, right? Anyway, Hoover spied on King and many, many, many other people. In a very short period of time, he focused most of his attention on the Black Liberation Movement and the Black Panther Party in specific, and deemed the Black Panther Party to be the number one threat to national security in the United States. And he authorized COINTELPRO through the FBI to engage in all sorts of illegal activities against the Black Panther Party. In the early 70s, a group of daring young activists broke into the FBI office in Pennsylvania, and they found the documents that showed the existence of COINTELPRO. Up until that time, nobody knew that there was an organized program by the FBI to attack and destroy the Black Panther Party and many, many other left organizations. Congress convened a subcommittee headed by Senator Frank Church, who's a Democrat from Utah, not normally who you'd say would be your most radical congressman, to oversee hearings to investigate COINTELPRO. And the result of the Church Committee hearings were to find that the activities of COINTELPRO were absolutely illegal in any society, no matter what the stated mission was. Now, fast forward to 9/11. Immediately after 9/11, remember the Patriot Act and Homeland Security? All of the measures that the Church Committee had deemed to be illegal under COINTELPRO were reinstated under the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. And nobody really understood clearly what was going on because the government was capitalizing on fear. Mm-hmm. But during the COINTELPRO years, the late 60s and early 70s, hundreds and hundreds of political and social activists were incarcerated. Some were framed, such as Geronimo Pratt, who served 27 years for a murder in California that the FBI absolutely knew he had not committed. Daruba bin Wahad here in New York, who served 19 years for an action that the government knew he had not committed. Over 30 members of the Black Panther Party were assassinated by FBI agents and with the help of local law enforcement. Perhaps the most famous was in Chicago when Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, leaders of the Black Panther Party, were assassinated in their sleep and the floor plans for the house where they were murdered was provided by an FBI informant by the name of William O'Neill, who later committed suicide. The FBI, along with Chicago police, raided that the Panther headquarters in Chicago in a pre-dawn raid and shot Fred Hampton, I think, 21 times in his sleep. William O'Neill had drugged him the night before, so he was in no position to even attempt to hide or protect himself. But there were many, many other Panthers gunned down in the street. That's the backdrop for the existence of political prisoners in this country, and they have served between 25 and 42 years behind bars. And if they were social prisoners, not incarcerated in any way connected to their political activity, the overwhelming majority of them would long since have been released from prison. What we have today is another group of men who are being charged for political activity. And some of you may have heard back in January of this year, on the 23rd, in fact, 8 former members of the Black Panther Party were arrested across the country. One man lived in Florida, 3 are here in New York, and the rest were in California. And they are being charged with, 1, the murder of a police officer in 1971 in San Francisco, and 2, a conspiracy count alleging 9 overt acts of murders of police officers and bank robberies between 1968 and 1973 that are alleged to have taken place in New York and California. This is a state prosecution in California being led by the California State Attorney General. They have intentionally circumvented the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. The San Francisco District Attorney's Office was not informed or consulted at all with respect to this investigation and prosecution. But one of the things that's most troublesome, and there's many things that are troublesome about this new prosecution, is the fact that it is totally based on torture. And by that I mean the following. In 1973, 2 years after the incident at Ingleside Police Station, 13 members of the Black Panther Party were arrested in New Orleans. Some of them were singled out and tortured over the period of the next 5 days. Those men were Reuben Scott, Harold Taylor, and John Bowman. Detectives from New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and the FBI joined the New Orleans police in the interrogation. What would happen is the New Orleans police would torture the men, then they would leave the room, and the detectives would come in the room and interrogate them. If they didn't give the answers to the questions that the detectives wanted, then the detectives would exit the room, and the New Orleans police would resume the torture. They did things like use electric cattle prods. First, they stripped the men naked. They separated them, stripped them naked, used electric cattle prods on their bodies. They chained them, their arms and their legs, to chairs. They took wool blankets dipped in buckets of boiling water and put them over their bodies. They took plastic bags and put them over their heads, causing them to almost suffocate and pass out. And then they would take the wool blanket drenched in boiling water and throw that over their bodies. They would beat them with short blackjacks wrapped in rubber. They used a police ledger book. All of you know how big those police ledger books are. They would beat them with those. And this went on for the period of about 4 or 5 days until they finally gave the statements that the FBI and the local and the detectives wanted. Why does that form the basis of this investigation? Remember I said detectives from San Francisco were amongst the group that went to New Orleans. Those two detectives from San Francisco were named Ed Erdelatz and Frank McCoy. In 2002, Ed Erdelatz and Frank McCoy came out of retirement from the San Francisco Police Department and were deputized as federal agents. And they began going around the country questioning a number of former members of the Black Panther Party, including the men that they had tortured and many others. And Erdelatz and McCoy are leading the prosecution of these men today. So that is why I say that this case is based on torture. I think we passed out to you brochures about the case. On the back of the brochure, you'll see the website for the support committee, the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights. We had the foresight, before these men were arrested, to do a video of them so they speak in their own words about what was done to them. And that video is Legacy of Torture. a few copies of which I have here today. But it lays out in graphic detail the torture to which they were subjected. And I want you to know the methods used against them are the same kind of methods used in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It's eerie how similar the methods are. And the plastic bag technique is still being used today. 2 weeks ago, I did a radio interview with a station in New Orleans, and as I described the torture, the interviewer stopped me and he said, "We just had a young man die 2 days ago from the plastic bag technique that's still being used by the New Orleans police." So I'm sure I've probably gone over time. I haven't? Never tell a lawyer they have more time to talk, right? But in any event, I'll say we have a support committee. I'm sure when we do the Q&A, I'll have an opportunity to answer some more specific questions. I hope that you all will give support to these men. As I said, the website listed on the back of the brochure, if you go to that website, you can sign up for the listserv so you can get updated information. We're trying to raise money. Bail for them right now is $3 million apiece. Right. So if anyone wants to write a personal check. But we're certainly working on trying to reduce the bail so that we can get them out. They're due to appear in court again on March 13th, this Tuesday. We have a wonderful group of lawyers who have committed their time to representing them. The federal government is totally funding the prosecution of them, but the county of San Francisco has to figure out how they're going to fund the defense. And the county has already said that there's no way they have enough money to fund the defense. On that end, I'll stop and I'll turn the mic over.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Fire.
That was Sophia Elijah, who serves as Deputy Director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard Law School. We turn now to hear excerpts of a speech from author Anthony Arnove at the Left Forum this year. The panel is entitled Iraq, What's at Stake? Anthony is author of the book Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, examining why continuing the occupation is wildly unrealistic and a reckless strategy that makes the world a more dangerous place. Let's have a listen.
The fundamental political reality is that the U.S. occupation, not al-Qaeda, not Iran, not Syria, is the reason for the insurgency in Iraq, which is why no amount of surges of additional troops, programs for police training, rhetoric about cutting off supply routes to Iran and Syria, or plans for victory is going to end the resistance to U.S. occupation. Iraq today is an unqualified disaster, even from the standpoint of the U.S. ruling class. One can now regularly read on the pages of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal establishment observers who proclaim Iraq the greatest foreign policy mistake in the history of the United States, greater than even Vietnam. But that does not mean that we can sit back and wait for the U.S. ruling class to come to its senses, correct its course, and end the occupation of Iraq and Vietnam in 1968. By then, indeed even earlier, it was clear that the United States faced a momentous defeat. But rather than retreat, the political elites in Washington escalated the assault on Vietnam and expanded the war to Laos and Cambodia with devastating consequences, using arguments very similar to the ones we now hear being made about Iran and Syria. The threat of the U.S. expanding the war in Iraq is quite serious. In summer of 2006, Washington sponsored the disastrous and bloody Israeli invasion of Lebanon, hoping to gain some tactical advantage in the region and hence in Iraq. The gamble failed miserably, but some feel another such roll of the dice is necessary. Seymour Hersh wrote recently in The New Yorker, "Many in the White House and the Pentagon insist that getting tough with Iran is the only way to salvage Iraq. It's a case of failure forward," a Pentagon consultant said. "They believe that by tipping over Iran, they would recover their losses in Iraq, like doubling your bet." The U.S. is consciously fueling regional sectarian conflicts in a game of global divide and rule that raises the stakes of the civil war in Iraq to frighteningly dangerous levels. Gilbert Ashkar has an excellent interview called Lebanon and the Middle East Crisis in the current issue of International Socialist Review, and I think he points out very accurately, If one had to summarize Washington's policy toward Lebanon as well as towards Palestine, it could accurately be described as incitement to civil war. Civil war between Palestinians and civil war between Lebanese, not to mention the unfolding civil war in Iraq. Washington is pushing for civil war. It is resorting to the only ideological weapon that it has and its Arab partners have found to counter Iran's influence in the area, which is sectarianism, with consequences that are really horrible to contemplate. And I think we should be clear that, as Arun said in his opening comments, the crisis in Iraq and the region is not simply a question of George Bush and the Bush regime. The problem we confront in Iraq is much deeper than that. The Democrats came into a majority in the House, the Senate, and the state governorships last November as a result of a vote against the war in Iraq. Yet what have they done since taking office? For all the laughable rhetoric about exporting democracy in Iraq and the Middle East, which is the opposite of U.S. intentions, we now see again how little democracy we have at home as well. So far, the boldest measure the Democrats have been able to muster was to pass a non-binding House resolution criticizing the additional 21,500 troops Bush has sent to Iraq. Not the underlying occupation, not the military bases, not the economic occupation, not the presence of 100,000 private mercenaries operating without any accountability. The deaths, though, of Iraqis are binding. The deaths of U.S. soldiers are binding. And let's remember that the Democrats, certainly the party's key leadership, voted overwhelmingly to support Bush's invasion, that they have repeatedly voted to appropriate more funding for the occupation, and now many leading Democrats are pushing to add more than $17 billion to Bush's $100 billion supplemental funding request for the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Only now that the occupation is widely recognized as a complete disaster do you have Democrats voicing muted criticism of the war, but much of it is utterly superficial. The debate today in Washington remains one largely over tactics, not strategy or principles. In fact, the one debate over principles that is taking place is a racist one. You hear more and more people saying, including many leading Democrats, that Bush's real folly was in thinking he could bring democracy to Arab or Muslim people, who we are told have no tradition of democracy, are from a sick society, a broken society. In a much lauded speech to the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, Barack Obama, the great new hope of the Democrats, said there should be no more coddling of the Iraqi government. The United States, he said, is not going to hold together this country indefinitely. Richard Perle, who was one of the main enthusiasts for the invasion of Iraq, now says he underestimated the depravity of the Iraqis. Hillary Clinton recently gave a speech in which she asked, "How much are we willing to sacrifice for the Iraqi people?" Let me repeat that. How much more are we willing to sacrifice? As if the Iraqis asked us to invade their country, make their lives hell, and now are letting us down, not holding up their end of the bargain. It's also worth taking a look quickly at the Democrats' actual proposals for withdrawal. Russ Feingold has put together a proposal. He's at the extreme left wing of the Democratic Party, which he says would get troops out of Iraq by July 1st, 2007. But, he says, my legislation would allow for a minimal level of U.S. forces to remain in Iraq for targeted counterterrorism activities, training of Iraqi security forces, and the protection of U.S. infrastructure and personnel. U.S. infrastructure and personnel in Iraq. We have to ask what that means. Of course, Clinton and Obama have positions which are even worse than that. Obama and Clinton have also been pushing arguments about shifting the targets in the region to focus more on Iran, Syria, and Afghanistan, and are reflecting a strategic move within top military planners towards a greater reliance on the projection of U.S. power in the region via air and space rather than boots on the ground. And if you've not read Barack Obama's speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee last week, take a stiff drink and do so, and send it to all of your friends. There will be growing pressure on all of us as the 2008 presidential election cycle continues to pick up to restrict the debate in this country to ever more narrow circles. But we cannot afford to fall into that trap. If we become a lobbying wing of the Democratic Party, we will become not more relevant, as some insist, but we will become irrelevant. The anti-war movement must maintain its political independence and must continue to mobilize to fight for its own independent demands, which I think first and foremost should be for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
You know, we're dealing with a very critical and crucial time. Most crucial and critical time that I've ever witnessed. Being as young as I am, you know. We all don't want to say nothing else, so we say as young as we are. Now I want to talk about the pronunciation and the realization. Now the educators, they call it ESP, positive thinking, right? Some of the people on the cross other side of the pond call it vibes, vibrations, astrology, and all those different things, you understand? But I call what it is what it is. What it is what it is. Look at him. Now you see, a brother, you take in the ghetto, you find a whole lot of crime. I can understand, hey, I know what it means. Being 9 years old before I got my first pair of underwear out of a store. You know, putting on a half-pressed suit from the pawn shop with tennis shoes, trying to be hip. So I know where it's coming from. Like the fella say, having catfish head stew. And look like the catfish went in there with his head and come out very quick and didn't leave nothing else. That's one thing the educators and the politicians and the establishment gotta remember. Now brothers need jobs. If you don't work, you can't eat. If you don't work, you can't eat. Get hip to yourself, good God, my brother, and get it from the street. You don't work, you can't eat. Sis, you don't work, Lord, you can't eat. So you got to have mind power to deal with starvation. And that's what we're dealing with. You see, we can't go back to the biblical stories. Two loaves of bread, or two little fishes, five loaves of bread. Two little fishes, yeah, and five loaves of bread. Now look here, too many brothers to go by that. Now I want your brothers to dig where we're coming from. Set your mind.